Welcome to the Hungry Heart Quest podcast. My name is Dawn. I'm your host. And with me today is my friend Thomas, who is a farmer, a mountain boarder, and not a geologist. Thomas, what else would you like to add, or would you like to correct any of those statements?
Well, thanks for having me. No, I try not to label myself, so it's up to other people. That's usually negatives, but that was a nice one. Thank you.
We hit 3 points. Farmer, mountain boarder, geologist, mm-hmm. and not geologist right. at the same time. Start with the mountain boarding. Tell me about mountain boarding, because I learned about mountain boarding from you. I had never heard of it before that. And then I learned about it and I was like, this is absurd. Why do people do this?
Yeah. So mountain boarding, if a skateboard and a snowboard had a forbidden love child and it was raised by wild mountain bikers, that's what mountain boarding would end up as. So it looks like a big board. You strap in like a snowboard. Mm-hmm. It has skateboard-like wheels, except they're pneumatic. They pump up. There's bigger suspension and steering. And then you ride any kind of all-terrain you wish. It was developed in the early 90s. It actually developed in a few places around the world, the U.S., Australia, and Europe, U.K. specifically. Independently came up with boards. Very different designs, but all kind of moving towards that goal of being able to ride the mountains on a board in the summer.
I didn't know that it started, or that it was big in the UK. Like, I guess that kind of makes sense, like, given your family history, but that you might have learned about it.
Yeah. Well, it got very, very big. There was according to legend, there was a quarter in the, I think it was like 99, where they outsold snowboards for a quarter. So everyone was expecting this to be the next thing. We're all in on the ground level. It's going to be in the Olympics. sports like this have a very predictable history cycle. And we're in the well-established but quite underground phase of of things. There's a bunch of dedicated riders, but yeah, we don't get a lot of attention anymore. TV doesn't like the extreme sports. It's out of fashion.
I would say TV likes extreme sports that have flashy and cool tricks.
Yeah.
So I got to come to your mountain boarding competition last summer. And of course, when you're like, oh, these people strap themselves to a board and then they go down a very raw all-terrain hill. That doesn't sound super exciting, but as somebody who was there, I was like, oh my goodness, why do people do this to themselves?
So safety-wise, the consensus now after 30 years of people doing this is it seems to be more dangerous than snowboarding and less dangerous than skating.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So I guess. So it looks really super gnar and blah, 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 blah. But wear the protective equipment and you can get unlucky like any sport.
You have like full armor. Yeah. it's like an exoskeleton.
Of a underground sport, I am a proponent of a even rarer breed, which is big mountain downhill, which is really seeing some ridiculous hill face and be like, you know what? I'm going to go do that. there's freestyle is much more popular, which you have a big jump and people do backflips and all kinds of spins and grabs and the flashy stuff. Mm-hmm. Even when it was popular, that's what was easy to film, and the flashy. The downhill can be very hard to film because I'm in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'm going quite a long way. So.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, we're working on that. I'd like people to be able to see some of the adventures.
Mm-hmm. The competition that I got to come and see was at your farm.
Yep.
But they're all over the country.
Now. There's been a big push in recent years. It's called We the Riders. You can find us at wetheriders.org. And it's a grassroots effort to get some mountain board events again because the big sponsorship money dried up. Like 90s, early 2000s, Red Bull would show up and drop $500,000 and bring all the cameras and people would show up, and that was great. And that went away, and then people were doing nothing but whine about how that went away. So some of us kind of got together and like, well, kind of a play on words, is in the American circuit, like, you want it, you do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very proud that the Big Run is part of that movement.
Yeah. Talking about you having a farm, how long have you had a farm?
I moved back to Montana in 2015. I quit my job and was like, no, for real. My life now revolves around actually, I mean, who doesn't have dreams about having a little farm, you know, a few sheep? And it'll all be great and easy and life will be simple.
What's funny is that you sounded really British in that moment. A few sheep.
Yeah, so I had some mental health challenges I was working through, hence moving back to Montana. But as I kind of reoriented and decided what I actually wanted to do with my life, I was on this family piece of property already. So I kind of worked up to it and quit my previous job and got some shift work. And then I'm going to be a farmer. That was 2019. And I gave people this big speech about how the world was going to get really, really scary. And not for real. And former boss kind of gave me a look. You know what happened next year? So I had one short fall season to kind of start really pulling that property together. And then it was 2020 and I was farming. So I'm very happy to say I quit my job and started a farm before crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Like it came from a place of people thinking the world was great and me taking some rather extreme steps in an idealistic direction. Lots of people started farms in 2020.
When you say idealistic, say more, because I do not consider you an
idealist. Oh, it's
bonkers.
this idea is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Like, it's bonkers. Especially in our culture, choosing subsistence agriculture as your life goal, it comes with a lot of baggage, which I kind of wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard all by itself. Yeah. So it's a move for sure.
I mean, I understand that there's definitely resistance just from kind of the expectations of our culture now of like big agriculture is a thing that sustains us and people don't do that. We have robots to do it. And like,
oh, yes. The second you say you're on a farm and your farm does not look like a farm to what people see as farm, then it's like, well, are you actually even doing anything? Mm-hmm. I can show you a field that is, to my definitions of prosperous and healthy, doing great and being part of my systems in my farm and stuff. Other people see it and want to bush hog it because it does not look like a farm. It doesn't look like a wheat field. It doesn't look like sheep in a pen. I'm really trying to explore technology that is not standard. Trying to find a better way to live is the whole goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple of questions. One relating back to your experience coming from a colonizing culture and what that is like to work with the land that you're working with now, but also the permaculture side of it. And I say permaculture kind of for lack of a better word. I know a good amount about permaculture as it is like prescribed. And people, I feel like people might be upset that I say prescribed permaculture. But the thing is that it
is. let me cast the mad beef and let you off the hook. How about that?
All right.
People can blame me.
Sounds good.
Mad shade. My parents emigrated to America and had me almost immediately. Got married and had me. Very on plan. You know, in the 80s, like, America's booming and we're gonna move to America and boom with it. My dad worked for a large industrial company as a industrial engineer. He followed that job to America, and my mother followed him. He's very good at what he does.
I mean, having met your dad, I'm like, he is industrious, so that's for sure.
I was born in South Carolina, so first generation American. The family was pretty good about getting out and seeing America. But it was always in the context of new and interesting things. Like we did a lot of history because like the history of America was like novel to my parents and I guess important to me and my brother. Me and my brother ended up being homeschooled. So we got tailored science educations, help with my learning difficulties. Looking back now, we were an English family in America, observing Americans with a certain attitude, let's say. So us being homeschooled and my dad having worked his way up quite a bit, he got offered an opportunity to expatriate to Hungary to help them. They had big industrial company had acquired smaller industrial companies that had survived the Iron Curtain lifting. I'm sure you can tell how that story goes. They were building and expanding factories. My dad was there to help, but also instill that corporate culture over there. So that was his job. He offered a ton of money to do it. They offered it to us partly because he knew what he was doing, but also because us kids were homeschooled already, mm-hmm. still in high school. So we could just
pick
the books
and move
across the globe. They didn't have to provide. There was like an English school in Budapest, but we were nowhere near Budapest type of thing. So we were, you know, good colonists. We were mobile. The culture went in a box and the tea set went in a box and then got taken out wherever. Another great experience. Hungary's lovely. Yeah, I got to spend a lot of time exploring Hungary and finishing off my high school. Because I was me, I had fixated on paleontology as what I was going to do. Most kids go through the dinosaur phase. And I hit it right when Jurassic Park was happening. And
I thought you just told me before we started that you hate dinosaurs.
Well, yeah. But, you know, every kid has the dinosaur thing. Being a bookish kid, I also learned a lot of science with it. I knew there was more to life than dinosaurs. And actually in South Carolina, I had a volunteer job with the local geology museum, and we got to go do paleontologist run. And so I was getting very involved with paleontology in the Carolinas, looking at college options in South Carolina for paleontology, which is not great because we were in Hungary. Definitely moving back to the U.S. It was all out-of-state tuition. I finished high school and was the first to head back to the U.S. on my own.
Oh.
I got to pick where I landed back in the U.S. because, you know, it made no difference tuition-wise. And Montana State has one of three or four actual paleontology, named paleontology degrees in the country. The website made it look beautiful, and it was like the best fit. So me and my mom took a trip here in January in Montana to to visit the college and see if it was going to work. And my mom dropped me off at the offices to talk to people and went and talked to a realtor.
Is that how your family ended up getting the piece of land that you have now?
They all followed me to Montana.
That's
which is
such
pretty
an
funny.
Interesting thing. So you came here in January.
Yep. So we came here in January. The sun came up. We came in, it was like blizzardy and cold.
Yeah.
And couldn't see a thing. But the sun came up on the Lewis and Clark balcony. Big view of the Bridgers. Oh, wow. This is actually a nice place. Never mind the college. So literally, she dropped me off at the college to go talking to professors and financial people and stuff. And she went and started talking to realtors, like, immediately. There was fish and wildlife at the college for my brother, so he followed. So we ended up together again, which is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went first, and then my brother came. And then, speaking of that colonizer history, my company offered my father Poland next. So they expatriated to Poland whilst I'm in college. They were trying desperately to get him to go to India. Thankfully, we talked him down from that one because he was getting old, and India's actually rather colonists with compounds and drivers and stuff. Those European ones, you could wander around and you were relatively okay.
Yeah.
Big white men in India. Big British white men with zero sense running around India telling him what to do may have ended a little spicier.
Yeah.
He got to retire before all that. And bought a big, flashy mansion in the hills of Montana. It ended up burning down, unfortunately, and they moved to the city in Bozeman, but the land was still there. At that point, I had had my little journey.
Your journey slash crisis.
Journey slash crisis. There was a place for me to move back to Montana with the family in shame and failure.
So something that I noticed while you were talking is when you're talking about your dad getting job opportunities, they offered him Poland. Yeah. Like, it was like, here's a country. Have a country.
Yeah, it's like, no, this is what colonialism looks like when you run out of brown people to take over. It is a large French industrial firm with some great history with using colonial networks to do an industry. I'm going to not talk about who they are.
Mm-hmm. So we come back to the farm.
The farm, yeah. So I get my geology degree. I follow a girl to Missouri, and we're happily married for 2-3 years. During that time, I use my geology degree. The paleo comes with the geology to work in the oil fields in North Dakota as the on-site geologist doing the geosteering. All very interesting. My first job out of college was 6 figures. You know, I'm on the track, right? I went to college, got a sweet job, and a nice wife. I mean, I made it a bit further along that fake road than a few people. I knew this going in, and this is no surprise, but the oil field is pretty awful. It is the business end of empire. I'm culpable in the destruction of beautiful land in North Dakota. I guess I'll pay for it sometime. My mental health is also starting to make itself known in a big way. So, I quit that job. I always intended to. Like, it was always you do your time in the oil field, but only crazy people stay.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rough scene. Very boom town. There were people earning millions a year sleeping in the Walmart parking lot because there was nowhere to stay in Williston. It was the first time I ever saw, this would be back in 2012, empty shelves. Just couldn't ship it in, stuff in fast enough.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's an interesting, especially given the choice to become a farmer on the edge of a global crisis.
Yeah, so I'm sitting
interesting comparison.
I'm sitting in my little office in my trailer reading, there's downtime and reading books on nature, spiritual. I was always pagan AF.
As
foretold. I'm reading my books on nature, spirituality, and the crisis of the world, and looking up out my window, and there's the oil rig all lit up, flaming. When I go to hell, it looks like an oil rig at night, and I just know it. I still have dreams about out there. I saw some pretty good violence. Narrowly avoided it myself. There were people I worked with just died. Those rigs take diesel and men and grind it up and spits out black muck that enriches a few people. That wasn't real social justice anything, because nature good, we should take care of it, all that good stuff. But having to sit for months at the grinder end of how our culture works. Everything we do is oil. All our food is based on oil. All our communications based on oil. In the West, we have developed one good trick, which is to take the energy and oil and do miracles with it.
Mm-hmm.
That means that at all costs, land and people get shoveled into the drill head, and out comes the black.
And dinosaurs.
Nope, no one gives a shit about dinosaurs. I did some good work in paleo while I was in college. I did not decide the really competitive, I mean really competitive for the very few paleo positions was not for me.
Mm-hmm.
The plan was a wife was going to get her engineering degree, a higher education first, because that would pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd swap. She now works for a large company I will not name, doing things I'm not allowed to talk about. So she's rolling. She's good now. But yeah, my mental health basically collapsed.
And you were told to buy a motorcycle?
Yep.
And now you're on a farm.
Oh, yeah. No, we did. Yeah, we did the oil field things. People were like, yeah, go buy a truck. The way they got people to do stuff in the oil field is to throw money at them. Literally. So yeah, I got to buy toys and fix up the house back in Missouri, even though I was hardly ever there, all that good stuff. But yeah, eventually that fell apart, as I fell apart. Wife left me. I'm bipolar and zero treatment, zero help. And so I moved back in with the folks back in Montana and started that mental health journey. Extremely jaded, a little wiser of how things go, and a little more motivated to find a better way to live. I end up with, through no effort on my part, complete luck, and because I was a leaf in the wind while I was sick. But yeah, I end up literally on a cabin on acreage in Montana. Take the hint, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Few years of staring at it and thinking about it while I'm working another job in Bozeman, and then Yeah, I quit my job and announced to my folks that I'm going to be a farmer.
How'd they take it?
Better than I thought. I have done strange things before.
Yeah. One of the thoughts that I have, and I don't think I've ever asked you this before, because I've heard your geology story before of leaving the oil fields. How much, I'll say if any, though I think that it's safe to say that there is a part of your decision to be a farmer was some act of penitence.
I will pay for what I did out there, no matter what I do. I believe that. I think there's karma that comes with that, which I'll just bear. That's how that went down. But I don't have to keep living that way.
Yep.
I don't have to fall to despair and be like, well, what else am I supposed to do? It was traumatic, and I think it radicalized me for sure. I've always been extremely stubborn, and I've always been a bit odd, so.
It's why we're friends.
It's why we're friends.
One of the many reasons we're friends, Thomas.
Yeah, it's an enormous motivating factor in my life. Because y'all are also complicit in what's going on out there.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of what I saw, like, of the machine, the system. I mean, I hung out at the grinder end. I mean, I could have been like my buddy and gone to Afghanistan and be at the pointy end. Or people see bits of this thing. What you do with that's up to you.
I think it says a lot that you decided that what you were going to do was find a better life that largely involved taking care of land and learning how that land works and operates. And you've talked a lot about how there's prescribed permaculture and that does not work here.
Yeah. Well, yes, it absolutely can. I went and learned a lot. I took courses. I mean, I didn't just, I'm going to be a farmer and then march outside. Right? I did do some reading, watched a bunch of YouTube. I took some courses from a gal here in Bozeman, Corrine at Broken Ground Permaculture. She does wonderful stuff. Everybody look her up. So permaculture is great. I would critique that the culture of permaculture has fallen to the same machine as we were talking about earlier. I do not have a Kopp pizza oven, and I do not have a herb spiral. Am I actually doing permaculture? Right, right. It's that thing again of what does a people have an image of what a permaculture farm looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while too. It's like, all right, I've got to plant all these fruit trees, and I've got to do this and that, and then I'll have a really lush, jungly permaculture thing. And then just one day, and this is something that's been the most valuable, and an actual permaculture exercise, which is just spending time wandering around my property, staring at things. I realized that's not what this place looks like. I have this wonderful grassland from time immemorial. How does this grassland and low shrubby stuff become part of my culture?
Yeah.
How do I live here in a better way? I also take a lot of inspiration from the homesteading people who have a very different philosophy, and they are a lot better at getting it done. They always have full pantries, and they're always more financially stable and stuff like that than permaculture folks.
Mm-hmm.
You can play at permaculture and it'd be okay. Like, playing at homesteading is silly. And this is just different scenes of people. I even do look at farming industry. Really, there's not a lot there because it's all... This is a collection of things we're going to push into the grinder and get money out of the back end.
Mm-hmm. Originally, when we first started talking, you talked about choosing subsistence agriculture, which I think more homesteading. But you have, at least from my observations, leaned more towards the permaculture side if we're looking at the defining aspect being a full pantry. And I think an important thing to look at...
Listeners, please note she didn't introduce me as a successful farmer.
Hey, you're doing just fine. But one of the things to think about, I think, with permaculture versus homesteading and that idea of subsistence agriculture versus permaculture is that a big part of the values is not just that we're sustaining ourselves, but that we are in relationship with the land.
Yes.
And helping the land be sustained.
Correct.
And that sometimes comes at a sacrifice of your pantry being empty.
Yeah, but in permaculture, one of the key principles is obtain a yield. Mm-hmm. The original guys were like, no, we actually have to feed people. And it can absolutely be done. I'm not down on permaculture at all.
But it's not as easy. It's not that easy.
Yeah, like,
and it takes a long time.
Yeah. It took years of wandering around my property smoking, staring at things. The number of times I'm just idly staring at a thing I've stared at many times in many seasons. And then just suddenly I can see where it plugs in. And suddenly it's like a paradigm shift of a wow. This space or I'm carefully using resource. Suddenly a waste stream becomes a resource. It can have these moments of clarity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a very clear picture of your land because mm-hmm. I've been there many times, and there's different parts of it. There is the like pasture fields, and there's the stuff down by the barn and the little pond area. Mm-hmm. But then if you go above the cabin, you get into very rough country.
Yeah.
And even if it is all maybe under, you know, Lost Sheep Ranch and mm-hmm. your name or whatever,
yep.
parts of it are not yours.
Not by a long shot.
Yeah. Who do they belong to, Thomas?
Well, my community. People and more than people. Yeah, up top it becomes not pristine. That's not a real thing. Self-governed Montana, very rapidly. Full megafauna, bears and the mooses. And so, you know, there's my freedom of movement is not absolute. I cannot sally forth upon my land as an extension of empire and have my right of passage unchallenged, which I love. Mm-hmm. Those things are things I've begun to cherish. During the winter, the snow blows in and dictates my getting in and out, and I've come to understand that that's good. That's living there like I live there. Sometimes the mountains say no. Some folks would see that as a challenge to their sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
I see this in the homesteading, yes, but it's like permaculture too is just as guilty of, okay, we're gonna save the world with a permaculture farm. Fantastic, great sentiment. Please do that. Everyone, please do that. So what we need is 40 acres of terra prima, untouched by the hand of man, wilderness to start, right?
I know a handful of people who picked places that are quite destroyed,
yes,
and are rehabilitating them.
Because we do have good permaculture people around here. Like the best place to do the best permaculture stuff I've seen. Some of like the actual fully integrated chicken house here, and it immediately goes into the bed, and it's like all beautifully drawn out with the colored pencils. But and actually working and producing food for a whole neighborhood was in St. Louis.
Hmm.
And they built it on rubble. Most of St. Louis is built on St. Louis. So they started with zero soil. They built everything. That's permaculture. This myth of terra incognita with no people there. That's the colonist dream. Mm. That's the story. America was empty and then we fixed it. Right? That's the story. And we still play that story out. We absolutely, like this, we moved to Montana and we bought pristine wilderness and we built our house and our road. Is us enacting that mythology about ourselves. That kind of thing's very on my mind when I'm making decisions on that place. Kind of not do that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. In your work as a farmer and in getting to know the land that you live on, are you mending relationships or breaking relationships?
I think it's all of the above. There are certainly bad relationships in place that I inherited. Again, the story of our country. We all inherit those. You can either ignore them and implicitly follow them or try and tackle them, and that's hard. There are broken relationships. When I moved there, the pastures were an absolute wreck because a pasture is a space with a resource that you utilize. In the big story, you have a pasture, you put horses on it, and then they eat the grass, and then you have horses. The pastures were an absolute wreck. Like when I first saw the small pasture, it was bare dirt for 2-3 acres. All relationships gone, bare earth, empty space, as we like so much in our culture. Being reduced to uniform space, which seems to be our main project, turning everything into everything else, erasing differences. So yeah, like helping those pastures to re-flourish has been a big part of a few of the decisions we've made. We do not rent to horses anymore.
Instead, you bring in beloved goats.
Yep. So we do goats to handle weeds. Very important. My definition of a weed is a plant where you don't want it. And this is all learning stuff. Like when I started, I was like, yep, we're going to take care of all the noxious weeds. And I like got the handy dandy state book on what ain't all of the noxious weeds. But then taking the weird step, I was like, well, who is this plant? What's it doing? Why are these two so different? Why is this list a list?
Mm.
I have some thoughts. But I don't do noxious weeds anymore. But there are definitely plants that need negotiating with. Some of them are there for a job. Sometimes that job is, well, you've abused your pasture for 50 years and now you've got a dirt lot full of undesirable plants. Oh no, call the state to blow shit all over it. That's one attitude. Or you'd be like, well, those thistles are there because the soil's compacted and it's their job to send down tap roots and fix the soil compaction. Thistles don't last forever.
Especially when goats have been unleashed yes. upon them.
Yes, so we do use goats to take care of thistle and knapweed. Partly because, you know, this is still family land and my parents look at a pasture as a space with grass in it. I don't want to be too critical of my parents, but observing them do stuff has been important for me to understand colonialism. A plant doing anything but growing in a neat row, the reaction it can elicit in people is amazing. It's not just a nuisance, it's an existential threat to the realm. The level it's dealt with. The absolute line in the sand about getting blue shit from the state and blowing it everywhere. That was the first big step. It's like, we are not doing that. No, not ever. You know.
But it's worked, too. Choosing not to do that, your oh, yeah. pastures have gotten
doing so much regenerative better. Agriculture on it instead. Like, I am obtaining a hell of a yield off of that pasture. It's not just sitting. It's not just pretty and I'm just watching. That's the other thing people do is they... It's like, oh, pristine nature outside of the corrupting influence of man can absolutely take care of itself and prosper and immediately go back to terra incognita, unspoiled by the hand of man. Nonsense.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is a forester. That is like hot coals yeah. for a lot of people. If we're going from a science side, part of the biology of a forest requires disturbance
yes.
in order to thrive. And because of how our culture has taken that, how science has taken that, the idea of pristine wilderness and caring for wilderness, it means that those forests aren't getting the disturbance without intervention
yeah.
by man.
Permaculture is a culture, and we are absolutely part of that culture. The separation in people's minds between enclaves of the empire, which you're all sitting listening to this now in, and nature out there in nature places is toxic.
One of the things that I might be interested if you're willing to share is how your mental health has rebounded through the experience of working on the farm, seeing these relationships, mending these relationships, or even just bearing witness.
I failed out of life in 2015 and moved back in with my parents, completely crazy. And I had made the decision I was going to win my wife back. That was what was keeping me going through that. I was like, yep, she's going to be mine again, and I'm going to earn it.
Mm.
I'm going to get healthy, and I'm record her from ground up. About 3 months in, she let me know she was a lesbian, which, okay, well, that's not going to work, is it?
Yeah.
You know, that relationship, I was crazy, and she was a lesbian, and neither of us knew it when we started. And it was fantastic while it lasted, and now we're back to being best friends, so.
Yeah, I'm glad that you did let our listeners know that you guys actually are friends.
Yeah, no.
It's been a life journey in and of itself,
we're both
right?
We're both on journeys and some pretty interesting ones. Yeah, so I had like already bitten the bullet about going seeing the doctors. Very scary. I had already taken the plunge to, and I'd like decided like, all right, full hands on deck. This is what I do with my life right now is fix this. Handle this, manage this. I already have some attitudes about holistic stuff and everything. And to me, holistic also means the scary pills.
I want to point out another use of language here that I noticed is that you said fix, handle, manage, and
yep.
heal was not a single thing.
Well, it's
that.
A journey.
No, but I think it's an important thing to point out, because at that point, maybe that's what you were hyper-focused on.
A lot of it is attitudes about the body and healing and colonialism. Like, I'm in that context, right? My parents to this day feel like medicine is going to the mechanic, because a part does not work and they'll just fix it. Mm-hmm. They'll just replace it, and then all will be right with creation as it was meant to be. Power to them. 8 years later, the word heal is something I can consider as maybe a thing.
Mm.
Every decision I made since then has been in the context of my mental health and making my mental health better. Jobs I take, jobs I quit, whether an activity is good or bad, is it serving healing my mental health? So, A, I've worked very hard at it. But yeah, absolutely the farm and being outside. I mean, that's good for everyone, right? And work. Once I quit my job and started farming, I quickly realized I was going to work every day for the rest of my life really hard. But it was a different work. It was for me. It was on the path to this better way to live. Not even a better living, just a better way to live, like all connected up with nature and in relation. And so I got to separate that hard work from bad. Like, people are not happy on vacation because people do want to work. People want to pitch in and, like, be busy doing stuff. And I think a few people learned it during the pandemic. It's who you're working for. It's what you're doing. I have this little mantra I've been finding very useful recently when I feel like I'm not being productive enough or not working hard enough. Stop everything. What are you producing? And who are you producing it for? And why? Just answer those few questions. Like, when I'm on my shift and working for the co-op, I am producing value for the co-op in exchange for currency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. It's not good or bad. As long as I understand that, suddenly that relationship is just fine.
I have a thought.
Fantastic.
One of the things that I've talked about on previous episodes is that people need to be an active participant in their own healing.
Yes.
But that they're not doing it alone, but they're not just going to a doctor and saying, fix me. In order to really heal.
Not at all.
You have to have active participation in your own healing. In the case of going to multiple modalities for healing, like, I would consider the land a practitioner helping you to heal, right?
Yeah.
The land plays a role in your healing partly because it places different demands on you, not that it doesn't place them at all.
Kind of that overculture story is I work because I must, and I look forward to doing nothing. And that's a trick. The desire for idle time as the pinnacle of personal time is survival. Survival response, because we don't rest in this culture. I saw this again with the pandemic. People got 3 nights of sleep in a row, which was the greatest triumph against the machine that has happened in decades. Many, many huge swaths of the population rested and played their video games and watched Netflix, which we need to do to live. But then a lot of them woke up and started asking, what am I producing? And who am I producing it for, and why? Or probably not that coherent, more like, what? And started asking questions about, well, what do I want to do? Most people don't want a vacation for the rest of their life. That would be hell. That's awful. People go crazy doing that. That's not good for you. We want to do something.
People need purpose.
Yeah.
Which generally comes with activity. We live in a culture that doesn't promote purpose.
No, you are given purpose.
Right.
People who can decide their own purpose are extremely dangerous to that. We're calling it the machine today. Being able to self-determine your purpose is literally unplugging from the matrix. If your employer gives you purpose, or your country gives you purpose, or your church gives you purpose, that is someone co-opting your sovereignty. That's how you give away your power. It's how people die at their job, get completely bound up in their job because they've been assigned a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And they chase it because we want purpose.
Yep. Yeah. And I think working for purpose and the demands are related in that it is who is demanding this of you. Is it you demanding this for your own desires, for excellence, for whatever? Is it the people you're in relationship with? Is it your community, or is it the machine? And how much of the community is stuck or like enmeshed with the machine? And then we get into exit strategy. How do you drop off the face of the earth and decide to start a farm, you know, right before the world goes into crisis?
Well, what you do is you, to do that, to exit strategy, is you you go to Montana and you find pristine wilderness and you purchase it. And then that is your kingdom. That is your mini version of empire. And then you never talk to anyone ever again. The escape thing. I mean, that was on my mind. Like, that's a story that we carry. Just get away from it all and then it'll be fine. To actually engage in a world of relation and start tackling the big problems and find that better way to live is to dive headfirst into the very worst of what the world is offering. It's carrying with you that you live downstream of the grinder. It's understanding that you are a direct beneficiary of war crimes, present and past. Yeah, you don't get to hide. It's the opposite of hiding. I couldn't believe how terrifying it was. You know, if you just do what you're told and do your purpose as you're told and live in your little pod and play your PS5 in your beautiful time where you sit still and don't do any trouble, do nothing, you're shielded from all of it. They promise not to hurt you unless you're, you know, they feel like harvesting you. Engaging with this stuff is just terrifying in terms of how real it suddenly becomes and the security empire offers everyone is a real thing, and saying no thank you is really, really scary.
Okay, two things have come from that. First,
you wouldn't want to be seen as a weed, would you?
No, because I'm going to get sprayed or pulled or otherwise poisoned. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I have a feeling that this conversation is going to resonate with a lot of people or totally fall on deaf ears or anger a lot of people. And
this is definitely weed talk.
I'm here for it.
I hope to place weed spores in everyone's brains, but you know, some people know what their marching orders are and can identify this crap.
Mm-hmm. But coming back to security, I think that that's an interesting thing because if I tie it back to some of the health side of things, I have not read this book, but I have read other and heard podcasts about the author and the topics therein, but it's called The Comfort Crisis. This is something I played with a lot in the last couple of years and even before of this being willing to be in discomfort. And a big part of that discomfort is security. And so much of our culture's anxiety comes from this idea of, or this fear of loss of security. And part of that is comfort. Like, comfort is a luxury that comes with an illusion of security. The other thing that I was thinking about was, how do you feel about the term radical accountability?
Love it. Like, absolutely. People don't worry about things because they get told not to worry about things. You don't need to worry about this thing that's happening right now, or this thing that happened just a minute ago. That's in the past or far away or for us to deal with, and you just don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Half of North Dakota is fracked to hell, and it's your fault. You all gathered around the end of that pipe and supped up the oil faster than it can flow out. It was me and ostensibly other people kicking family farms off their land and poisoning their water and making it uninhabitable for the foreseeable future. We did the violence, and you ate the cream. If that upsets you, good. It's upsetting. A bad thing happened, and we're accountable for it. We're radically accountable for it. That's a threat to your standing in the empire. Yes, and good. Maybe your standing in the empire is the accountability you need to look at. That right to export your violence outside of your city. having your good neighborhoods implies your bad neighborhoods. If you live in a good neighborhood because you've exported your violence to the bad neighborhood, to your neighbors. Yes, 100% radical accountability. And it's not an overnight thing. And you don't need to, like, give away all your possessions. And it's not that big a threat to you. If you can do the work, then you're on side. And you may be a weed, so you have a whole extra new thing to worry about. But once people become accountable to each other, that's the relationship fixed.
Mm-hmm. It's not good or bad. It's relationship. It is that you are in relationship.
Yes.
And that you have accountability. You can do your best over time to make that a better relationship.
To bring it back to the farm, doing the meat chicken operation as per, by the book, as per Joe Salatin, if any of you can go on the internet and see what it looks like. I'd been hunting before with the same attitude of taking on that accountability of violence for a large vertebrate mammal surviving in the world means I live on the deaths of others. Period. I try to be gentle, but pretty down on veganism and this. When the world works, we won't hurt anything ever. No, we're not the top, but we are high up a food chain, and we live by the deaths of others. And really taking on board what it meant to kill a lot of something, to have enough for actually a long time, that puts me in relation to something. Those chickens. The relation is I murder and eat them. I mean, I gave them good little lives before and did my very best for them. And then I betrayed all that and murdered them and eat them. That's bad. That's stressful. But I didn't export it. Chicken didn't just show up in a bag as a material. I didn't have wage slave immigrants cut apart chickens for me and then shipped across the country from a farm where they live in a box and the farmer is being screwed by Tyson and the food comes from a cornfield in Iowa and I didn't export any of that nonsense, right? I took as much of that, what it means to be alive and eating meat, on myself, to be accountable for as much as I can, and working towards more accountability in that cycle. I live in a country where I am amazingly secure. I mean, it's not as peachy as they advertise in the movies anymore. It's getting a little rough out there, but I generally can wander around, especially as a big white dude. Please remember, I can wander around reasonably and talk to people and take opportunities and do adventurous stuff. You can't always do that. And I do that because I have exported the job of waving rifles at people to other people. Once I've exported that violence, seeing how the people in charge of that violence are currently using it makes me madder and it brings it home harder. Once I know that's for me on my behalf and behest, how that gets done becomes really important and really present, right? Yeah, radical accountability. Approved.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's up to us to keep ourselves accountable, even if we can have some outside forces like our friends and our community or cultural standards or whatever. Like in Bozeman, in a lot of ways, being accountable for where your food comes from is a little easier because, mm-hmm. like, the agricultural side of our culture here is much more imminent. People love going to the farmers market. We have conversations with the people who provide our food. Not everybody in Bozeman does that. Not everybody has the luxury to do that.
Yeah. This is a lot harder in Missouri,
for example. Believe it.
Like, we were in the middle of verdant farmland in Missouri, kind of a food desert. Mm-hmm. The health food store was full of supplements and kind of nothing else. It can absolutely be done anywhere. But here in Bozeman, it is offered up to us very, very easily. Yeah. We're extremely lucky here.
Living where we do, we are fortunate enough to use an analogy I heard on a different podcast, Alien Robot Tiger, on their culture episode. Culture is where you take bacteria and you put it in a nutrient bath and you watch it grow. Mm-hmm. We live in a city that functions as a pretty decent nutrient bath for the kind of culture we are trying to grow, something that is more sustainable. We also live in our culture where we do go to the farmers market, where we value the land, we're paying attention more. And the motivations for that are very different from person to person and neighborhood to neighborhood.
Let me stress, you don't need to full frontal assault the matrix and place your entire being on the line. If you just want to buy organic groceries, please just do that. Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Yeah. So coming back around to this idea of us being active participants in our own healing, that doesn't just mean good vibes only.
It doesn't mean
just working at the co-op and buying groceries. It means acknowledging that somebody's killing that chicken and it might be you.
Every breakthrough I've had with my therapist has been a ball session. It doesn't feel good. I feel bad. I don't want to do it.
Yeah, and so this idea of being an active participant and then combining that with radical accountability for our healing and the healing of our land and community and culture, it means maybe you're starting small on your own individual level. I've seen this with my health coaching clients. Is like they're coming in because they need help for their own health. When you start to see progress, it ripples out to their family, to their immediate relationships around them. And then you get to see that grow bigger and bigger and bigger into their view of their role and how they participate in their culture and the healing process in general.
Yeah. You cannot make anyone do anything ever.
Yeah.
Period. And I'm really big on not telling people what to do. But I'm going to be a weed all by my damn self out here in the pristine golf course. And the people who need to see will see and go be weeds themselves. We never win this. Being a weed is fighting anyway.
Yeah. Well, this has been...
Something.
Something. And I think something really wonderful, actually. I'm really excited to put this out.
I'm glad you got something from it, and I hope the listeners get something from it. Go and be weeds.
Thanks for listening.